This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. Night School on BFM 89.9.
I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Night School, a show that helps you understand fundamental concepts in social sciences. Joining me is Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and together we're going to walk you through some of the most important social theories of our time. Each week, Fuad or I will lead a discussion on a key concept or a classic text which can shed light on the world around you. Fuad, what do you have for us this week?
I thought it would be a good chance for us to talk about freedom.
So, okay, this is episode number one. So we're going to start with a really big concept, something that perhaps everybody understands at some level, right?
At some level, it's a big concept, but I think it's also necessary given the recent changes that Malaysians are witnessing in politics, right? So over the past 2 years, we've seen Bersih take place. And what it is essentially is a demand for freedom, right? The freedom to be heard as citizens, to have their perspectives and their concerns acknowledged by the government.
So you're talking not about the content, which has to do with electoral reform, but actually the form, the idea of going to the streets, of speaking directly to your government, demanding a response.
Correct.
That's really where the politics is in some ways, isn't it?
Correct. The demand for free and fair elections is a part of the larger desire for a freer Malaysia.
And that's something we see worldwide as well. We had the Arab Spring over the last 2 years.
Correct.
Freedom is a chant or a cry that has been, you know, actually it's been around with us for a long time, hasn't it?
For a long time. And as we'll discuss later, it's actually resonated over the past 200, 300 years in the period that people often refer to as the Enlightenment, or synonymously modernity, right? This ushered a new kind of politics that was not quite present in the medieval era or in antiquity. So part of our discussion is to get to the heart of the issue, right? Why is freedom so important for us? Why is it that people are willing to risk their lives, to risk their reputation, to risk their livelihood in order to be free? So rather than to look at these particular cases, we're going to address the essence of the issue. I think it's a good point of departure to look at Isaiah Berlin's very famous essay entitled Two Concepts of Liberty. And I think it's important because it's probably the most widely read essay in modern political philosophy. It's very frequently referenced, and the terms that he introduces in the essay continues to be used in most discussions about political philosophy.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Now, it's two concepts of liberty, not freedom. Now, are these two words synonymous?
They are synonymous, the way he uses it, yeah.
Okay, so what exactly is freedom and why is it important?
Okay, let's get to the basics, right? Freedom or liberty, in the most general sense, means autonomy and the absence of interference. The instinct that others should not stop us from doing what we want because we are the owner of ourselves, right? Autonomy is very key there, self-ownership. So to understand or to define yourself as free, you must first have a sense that you are your own person, that nobody else owns you. And it's important because, as we mentioned earlier, freedom has remained the organizing principle of modern politics, politics in the contemporary era. The prevalent guiding idea here is that all communities or individuals should be able to aspire to self-determination to the greatest extent possible without harming others. So when we speak of freedom, even when we talk about individual freedom, we are really speaking about freedom in the context of a broader society. And in this sense, the extent to which society is stable or harmonious depends a lot on how it manages, negotiates, or balances the many demands of freedom from its members, right? So you imagine in a city or in a nation, everybody has the right to believe that they are the owners of themselves.
So this actually, right, in some ways comes out of societies that have moved away from slavery. I mean, because in slavery,
correct,
you can imagine people are actually owned by other people.
Correct, correct. Right? So that's the major difference between modern politics and pre-modern or ancient or politics in antiquity, where women, children, and workers or slaves are practically the objects of other people who own them, right? And this was taken as part of convention, right? So in the modern era, there was a real paradigm shift that categorically denied the legitimacy of owning other people, be it slaves or women, right? So, yeah.
In the peninsula here, we've also had an ancient tradition of slaving.
Correct.
And the idea of merdeka, I think, also comes from the concept that a society that has slavery will have a notion of freedom too, because slaves can be freed. And,
correct.
And so you need a kind of conceptual bridge to get somebody from his position or her position as a slave to somebody who's a free man.
Yes, it is a radical paradigm shift, because to accept servitude is to really accept a different degree of worth than a free man, a free human being, for example. So merdeka is a good concept to illustrate this, right? Because etymologically, it is different from kebebasan. Right, kebebasan is sort of freedom to choose. Merdeka is freedom from slavery. And that's why it was preferred as a rallying cry for independence.
Ford, you've been doing an exposition of the ideas of Isaiah Berlin. Mm-hmm. Or are these your own ideas?
Oh, these are, it depends on which part we're talking about.
Like, we're talking about the first part.
Oh, the first part, it's been a mix. I mean, Isaiah Berlin, the ideas that Isaiah Berlin discusses has been imprinted in political philosophy 200 years before him. In fact, even before that, you know, to be more exact.
So maybe we could just start with you telling us who Isaiah Berlin is.
Sure. He has an interesting life, right? He's of Russian Jewish origin. His family lived under communist rule, but he eventually moved to Britain by the time he was 11. Four more freedoms, basically. And there he excelled in his studies. And to cut the long story short, he eventually settled there to be the world-renowned scholar and thinker that he's remembered for.
Now, I want to again interject at this point. Isn't it true in some ways, I mean, you kind of study this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. That ideas emerge from certain contexts. That right. It is precisely the, you know, the turmoil of the 20th century that produced a mind like Isaiah Berlin's.
And what he represents is an interesting intersection between two notions of liberty that prevailed in political common sense throughout the 20th century. And one of that notion of liberty is represented by so-called the West, or what they themselves refer to as the free world. And on the other, the Eastern Bloc, or the communist world, which has its own notion of liberty, which we'll talk about soon. And what he tries to do in this essay is try to explain what exactly these two differences in definitions of freedom represent, and where they overlap and where they don't. And for the most part, they don't. He claims that they don't. And this reveals, I think, centrally, in my opinion, the two polars of freedom that still remain today, even after the Cold War has ended. So the Cold War has ended two different types of regimes that claim to upheld two different notions of freedom, but the ideas nonetheless remain. Right.
Okay. So at this point, you're going to kind of walk us through some of the points that he makes in this specific essay.
Correct. The essay is well known for introducing two major categories of freedom. The first is negative freedom, and the second he calls positive freedom. These influential terms have been in frequent use in philosophical discussions on politics since Berlin introduced them. And before we get into defining what these terms are, I think it's important to have some caveats on how and what exactly freedom is within the context of politics. Because Berlin has in mind politics as the realm in which freedom is expressed. The first point that he raises is that freedom is fundamentally about action among other human beings. It is not about transgressing physical nature. It's not about the freedom to want to be tall when you're short. It's not about wanting to be free to be beautiful when you're not, right? Fundamentally, freedom in the political sense is about whether or not our desires contravene that of others and vice versa. It's not about wanting to fly or have superpowers. It's nothing like that. It's about how do you share the same realm of activity among men. So in a modern context, everybody is their own individual person, but you nonetheless have to live in a community.
So there's a kind of tension between the individual and larger society.
Correct. There is this perennial tension, perennial ambiguity between the desire of the individual and the desire of the larger collective. This is the context in which freedom is really understood and discussed and fought over. So this tension. As Berlin clearly states, the problem of freedom is the ill will of others. It's not objects, it's not nature. So a second caveat is that liberty is concerned with space and the scope of concern, not necessarily the source of power. What this means is that you can actually have legitimate elections and still not have a free society. The phrase, and I put in some quotes, the tyranny of a majority is one example of that, whereby you have a majority decision that is legitimate because it has gone through the proper procedures.
So it's legitimate and democratic.
Democratic, correct. But it nonetheless decides against the freedom of minority, for example. So in which case, only one side is freer than the other. The issue is not to be understood merely in procedural terms or governmental terms, but who ultimately has the power, which individual or groups of people actually has more freedom than others. The third caveat is that there is no such thing as absolute freedom. This would basically mean chaos, where everyone is allowed to do whatever they want to other people.
Well, often you hear this as a response to when, you know, people talk about censorship. They always, somebody will come and say, well, you know, freedom is not absolute. Which Correct. Is often an apology for censorship. It's a legitimization or validation of censorship, isn't
Correct.
It?
And if we read Berlin, what he says is that there is some truth behind that instinct to want to stop absolute freedom or to want to claim absolute freedom. Because the truth is, given that we live in a society, we don't live among only people who are alike, we always have to negotiate with differences. And that means that somebody has to compromise at some point. So there's no such thing as absolute freedom. The fourth caveat, freedom is not the mere absence of frustration or the avoidance of hurt feelings. Right? In fact, Berlin mentioned that freedom is distinct from justice and equality for that very reason. To want justice, to want equality, requires that some people concede their freedoms to make way for others, whether rightly or wrongly, whether determined properly or not. Right? That just happens in a world of differences. Compromise occurs. So what's sought after is minimal spaces where freedom may not be contravened, right? Not absolute wanton freedom. So these are the things that we have to keep in mind before we get into the more crucial concepts of positive and negative freedom that he outlines in the article.
We're going to take a break here, but let me play you a clip I found of Berlin speaking about the French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Here, Berlin is talking about what he considers a positive conception of the notion of liberty. You'll hear more about the distinction he makes between positive and negative liberty in the next part of our show. This is simply a taste of what is to come.
Rousseau is the author of The Monstrous Paradox, whereby liberty is a kind of slavery, whereby to want something is not to want it at all unless you want it in a certain special way, in which you can say to a man, you may think that you are free, you may think that you are happy, you may think that you want this or that, but I know better what you are, what you want, what will liberate you, and so forth. It is this monstrous paradox, according to which a man, in losing his political liberty and in losing his economic liberty, is in some way liberated in some higher, deeper, more rational, more natural sense, which only the dictator, or only the state, or only the assembly, only the authority knows, in which the most untrammeled freedom coincides with the most rigorous and enslaving authority. For that paradox, Rousseau is more responsible than any thinker who ever lived. The consequence of it in the 19th and 20th century, I need not enlarge upon. They're still with us now.
That was the late Isaiah Berlin speaking about the French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Next up, Fuad tells us more about Berlin's influential essay, Two Concepts of Liberty. I'm Sharad Kutin, and you're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Night School. I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and we have been talking about the essay by Isaiah Berlin. The essay is called Two Concepts of Liberty. Earlier, Fuad, you walked us through four important caveats in this discussion about liberty. The first is that freedom is about action among people. Secondly, that liberty is concerned with space and not with the source of power. Three, that there's no such thing as absolute freedom. And finally, freedom is not merely the absence of frustration or the avoidance of hurt feelings. But let's move on. So Fuad, what is the distinction that Berlin makes between negative and positive liberty?
I'll just go ahead and define it, I guess. Negative liberty is the absence of external coercion. No one is to interfere with another person's choice, whereby choosing is every person's fundamental right. Negative liberty indicates that a choice is free because there are no barriers or obstacles set by others. Negative liberty means you are free because no one is stopping you, right? And no one being no other individual or no power from the government. The question at the heart of negative liberty is explained by Berlin as follows. What is the area within which the subject, a person or a community, is or should be left to do or be what he is able to do or be without interference by other persons? Interference being the key word there. We actually hear this position a lot in everyday encounters and conversations, right? So when somebody says, leave me alone, let me do whatever I want, right? What they are expressing is basically a position of negative freedom. The consumption of alcohol is a good example. Nobody really says that it is a fundamental right to drink alcohol, but it's only enough to say that, hey, this is my life, my body, leave me alone, let me drink if I want to, right? So that's the kind of instinct behind negative freedom. The idea that you should be left alone to decide whatever you want because you own yourself. Nobody has the right to tell you what to do. You are the owner of your personhood, your character. When you believe that no one should be an obstacle to what you're choosing, basically, that's a stand on negative freedom.
It's a very intuitive concept, right?
It's very intuitive, yeah.
I mean, I think we learn as children immediately who are the barriers to our freedom. It's our parents. They were constantly saying, no, no, no. Yep. You know, don't pick that up. Don't throw it on the ground, you know.
Yeah.
And
you say, let me do what I want, you know.
Yeah.
You say, okay, no cookies before bed because you'll be like all hyped up all night. Say, no, let me do what I want. I want my cookies before I sleep. You know, so that's very negative liberty as it is expressed.
And I think teenagers probably up the ante because by the time you're a teenager, you can say, well, you can't stop me.
Exactly.
It's my life and you can't
it's
stop
my life.
Me.
Correct.
Yeah. When you're
correct.
A kid, you can't actually be physically stopped. But when you're a teenager, a bit more difficult. No. Okay.
Right. So, I think you're right to identify the very kind of visceral origins of that, right? But in political terms, you see it in appeals for things like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, right? In either case, rarely do the appeals take into consideration the content of the religion or what is being said. The ideal, at least as a starting point, is that no one should disturb others on matters of their belief or thought or speech, right? So
because it's personal?
It's personal and it belongs either to the individual or the community, right? So you can't say what Muslims should or should not do because the religion believes belongs to Islam belongs to Muslims, right? You cannot tell what Christians or Christians should not do because only Christians can talk about Christianity because religion belongs to them. So again, we see that underlying it is this theme of self-possession. Now, positive liberty is taking control over one's life. You must be able to control your own destiny in your own interest. It is the belief that ultimately you are the primary agent of your choices. Positive liberty connotes self-realization and flourishing. So Berlin summarizes the question of positive liberty as follows. What or who is the source of control or interference that can determine someone to do or be this rather than that? So let's get back to the alcohol example. This time, let's imagine an alcoholic. Viewed from the perspective of negative liberty, the alcoholic is free as long as no one stops him from drinking or not drinking. He can choose to be an alcoholic without anybody stopping him, or he can stop for himself. But either way, he is free because the choice is his. Now, the perspective of positive liberty is different. The alcoholic is not free because he is addicted to alcohol. Alcohol has controlled him.
But so, alcohol is not a person. Alcohol, in this example, is a thing.
Is a thing, correct. Yeah. However, he has been, one can say, swayed by alcohol advertising, controlled by others, right? And that other people wants is basically telling him that drinking is cool or that drinking will solve his problems, right? People are not directly in front of him. The people are within the system.
Correct. So with the concept of positive liberty, you can make a claim that people don't actually know what's best for themselves.
Exactly. And that's where the problem occurs, right? The common response is that who are you to say what I should do for myself? Who are you to tell me that my submission to the advertising industrial complex is not something that I want to do for myself? I shouldn't do for myself. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, what the positive libertarians will say is that the alcohol is not control of himself because the alcohol industry has effectively controlled his impulses and desires. So in political terms, to be free, according to the strand of positive liberty, is to take charge of the situation. And this can require the help of others to stop the alcoholic from drinking, or to change the system, whereby alcohol advertising would be banned, or even more radically, going to the root of it, profit would be dismantled, so on and so forth, right? So you already see the kind of two different impulses to freedom. One saying, leave me alone, and B saying, no, we all must pursue our potential to be the best people we can be.
Right. And we allow other people to determine what that best is.
Yes, that's fine.
Or we could determine it for ourselves.
We can, but if we can realize that self-determination among others, and which positive libertarians tend to believe that you should, then that's fine, right? So you find your self-possession, the highest potential of what your self-ownership can lead to among others.
Now, okay, why did he use the terms positive and negative? I mean, is there some reason to use that?
Okay, this is a great question, because in the spirit of objectivity and fairness, we do not want to see these terms, positive, negative, liberty, as qualitative terms. These merely signify what those freedoms ultimately express, right? Right.
So positive liberty is not better than negative liberty.
No, it's not. He does not. In fact, Berlin falls squarely on negative liberty. He's a liberal, ultimately. He believes that ultimately negative liberty allows for a safer state of affairs than positive liberty. And we can talk about that soon. But why is it called negative liberty? It's because in cases where negative liberty is expressed, you are basically negating any obstruction that comes your way. And positive liberty, you are affirming yourself. You're affirming a certain model or way of life. You're affirming a certain goal beyond self-possession.
Right, so in a concept of, say, positive liberty, you might actually imagine a better world.
Correct.
You might imagine an ideal society. Whereas in negative liberty, you perhaps use it in a kind of a critique mode. You're saying, okay, I live in this society. This is where I see obstructions to liberty. So I'm going to push back on things that obstruct my personal freedom. It's not a blueprint or a starting point for a better world.
It does not require a blueprint insofar as there are certain constitutional guarantees that assume negative liberty must be protected.
It's a minimum program for liberty.
Correct. Okay. Whereas positive liberty, like you say, hint to a goal beyond basic self-possession. Flourishing as an individual, find peace of mind, finding a state of well-being, right? Happiness, so on and so forth.
And what I really like about philosophers and the work of philosophy is that it's involved in these kind of, I mean, people might call it hair splitting, but I think it's actually refining our sense of what we mean when we use these words,
exactly,
right? So
exactly.
Liberty is a big word. Everybody can use it, but perhaps have, you know, as many different notions of what we mean when we use the word liberty or freedom. I understand that he then goes on to define or refine this idea, this distinction even further.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, and I think usually there are several problem cases that try to highlight the issues in how liberty is conceived. So there are some cases when they're both incompatible, and in fact, the prevalent wisdom when it comes to assessing what Berlin says is that they're in many ways incompatible. So the best case to show some of the dilemmas in liberty is the example of the contented slave, the deferential wife, right? The contented slave being somebody's happy being a slave. He's happy being a second-class citizen. He's happy cleaning toilets and making people's beds and not really having a life for himself. Deferential wife being, she's happy being a second-class to a husband. You know, to use perhaps an example in Malaysia, this deferential wife is probably happy being a third or fourth wife. She's happy getting lesser attention from the husband because of the many other obligations the husband, polygamous husband, has, right? She's happy doing cooking and cleaning. This is what she wants. She doesn't want to march for pro-choice cause or for
monogamy.
For monogamy even, right? She believes that, look, I'm a woman. My role is to be subservient to men. This is my choice. Stopping me. Don't stop me, right?
Okay.
So as the perspective of negative liberty would see it, they are completely free. The contented slave or the deferential wife are happy in their state of servitude and second-class citizenship. Now, they can choose, the slave and the wife can choose to fight against the circumstance. They can choose to be rebellious. They can choose for a better life. That's fine too, as long as nobody stops them. But as long as they choose, then they are free. Okay, so they can choose to accept the condition and be free.
Okay, so this is the problem for somebody advocating a negative libertarian view because it sets up a kind of moral dilemma.
It sets a moral dilemma.
Because how can we then, are we then, say, validating slavery or the subservience of women to men, right? A patriarchy. So how do they get out of it?
In my engagements with them is that they don't. I mean, most of the time, they bite the bullet and say, who are you? They get into a relativist kind of perspective. Who are you to say that accepting a subservient role for women is necessarily wrong? What makes your value judgment more valid than her? And what if slavery is practiced in some cultures and acceptable, it's perfectly legitimate? What if in some cases the hierarchy of free men and slavery reflects some kind of larger hierarchy between in the cosmos or something, between creator and created or something like that? So they usually get in a cultural relativist position, which, you know, if maybe perhaps for better discussion, it's kind of easy to get out of.
Okay, so I do want to ask at this point. It seems to me that perhaps the issue is a starting point. Now, if it might be more difficult to argue against the contentment of the deferential wife.
Yeah.
So a woman who gets into a marriage, she actively, voluntarily gets into it. She chooses to be a third, fourth wife, or she chooses to be a submissive first wife. I mean, you know, only wife, right?
Yeah.
And that happens too. But in the case of slavery, you look at, say, a tradition of slavery as a way of actually producing stuff as a part of an economy, then people are not actively choosing to be slaves. They're born into slavery.
Correct.
Right? So the difference would be, there is a difference there, isn't there?
Correct. And, well, I was getting to the second way out for liberals to argue against deferential wife or the slavery example, is to say that they will appeal to some natural instinct that humans have to negate. And what they say is the end of slavery is largely a credit to the slaves who, after several hundred years of resistance, rejected it themselves. It is not the white person, the well-meaning, enlightened white philosopher, who tells the slaves to do it. In some cases, they can be a strategic alliance with them. But fundamentally, history is made by the slaves' choices themselves. Since that is the case, what that's informed us is that changes, breakthroughs, freedoms are best left to the agents themselves. And if freedom is a natural instinct, which libertarians agree, then these changes will happen on their own accord. There's no need for an external government or individual agent to patronizingly tell women and marginalized to do it themselves.
Okay, that's an interesting argument. Okay, so where does this take us in terms of positive liberty now?
Okay, so positive liberty, the problem, as you mentioned and rightly mentioned earlier, is that it relies usually on a standpoint outside of an individual desire. So the heroin addict, to use an extreme example, one can argue, rightly I think, may not have the best perspective on his or her condition. That perspective, the more sober perspective, will come from someone outside of that person. Similarly, one can argue, people who are more committed to social notions of freedom, say the third wife perhaps is just her consciousness is not raised, has not reached a level where she values her positive capacity for freedom. So the problem is that when you look at the positive liberty position, when they advocate control, when they advocate well-being, when they advocate peace of mind, in the name of true, genuine self-ownership, is that you are effectively always relying on a larger external standpoint of rationality. They may not be there. Which is why, for liberals, like Isaiah Berlin being one, he always hinted that the positive position on liberty can always slide, or is a first step to the gateway to something of an authoritarian ideal of freedom.
Right, because I guess he lived in a world that was deeply ideological, where the contest was really around a vision of society.
Correct.
And those who were advocating a better world, more freedom and equality and justice, were also practitioners of some level of authoritarianism, in fact, totalitarianism.
Correct.
So in the name of the freedom of workers, you would oppress workers.
Correct.
I mean, so he saw the paradoxical development of that kind of dynamic, didn't he?
Correct. So he did, in fact, identify that there is an inbuilt paradox in positive notions of liberty. In the case of women, for example, the radical positive position would say these women who are subservient to the men, they are replicating patriarchy. They are replicating a system that denies the full realization of women's liberty. Therefore, these women who are complicit, something must be done against them. And usually what that something is state power. So the radical positive position would say, in the name of liberating all of womankind, those women, such as the deferential third wife, who participate in the patriarchal system, and in doing so replicate it or reinforce it, must be stopped.
They must be complicit. Stopped from being deferential.
They must be stopped from being deferential.
They must be liberated.
They must be liberated, right?
Against their own desires.
Against their own desires. Because ultimately, they are not in full control of themselves. They are letting others own them. So in order for everybody to be full owners of themselves, those who are complicit with the present system of oppression, something must be done to them. We've been discussing the issue of freedom. And as I started out saying, freedom is best encapsulated in the expression of absence of interference and self-ownership. Right? To be free is to say that you are your own person. And what Isaiah Berlin does is identify two strands, two definitions, liberty. The first being negative liberty, second being positive liberty. Now, negative and positive here are not qualitative terms. They just express the different types of impulse that's behind each of these terms. Negative liberty being you're negating any external obstruction to your choices. Positive liberty being you're affirming some higher value of self-ownership than mere choosing or not the absence of external coercion. So what we hope is for you to ponder about these issues. In fact, you can do so with us since we have a Facebook page.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
And our Facebook page is called BFM Night School.
Night School, yeah. You can type that in as the search space and hopefully you'll find us. And we welcome your insights and questions.
And we're going to be also posting the essay by Isaiah Berlin. Okay. So if you don't have a copy of it, you can read it online. But do give us feedback and we could come back to some of these issues. In fact, I think over the coming year, we're going to be going over issues of individualism, society and individual tensions, mm-hmm. the state and society and those right. tensions, as well as the way in which social scientists have tried to understand the complexities of modern life.
And I think one thing for sure is freedom, insofar as the modern state exists, freedom in its negative, positive manifestations, and the tensions between them will always surface as a concern.
As an example of a more recent discussion on the competing notions of freedom and liberty, you can catch a documentary called The Trap by Adam Curtis. It's available on YouTube.
The series of films has told the story of the rise of a narrow and peculiar kind of freedom. The last two programs have shown how politicians from both the right and the left came to believe in a simplistic model of human beings as self-seeking, almost robotic creatures. Out of this came a new and simplified idea of politics. No longer did politicians set out to change the world. Instead, they saw their job as being to deliver nothing more than what these free individuals wanted. And at the same time, we too came to think of ourselves as simplified beings, whose behavior and even feelings could be analyzed objectively by scientific systems which told us what was the normal way to feel. And both we and our leaders have come to believe that this is the true definition of freedom. There is no other. But there is. There is an alternative idea of freedom, but we have hidden and forgotten about it because it can be so frightening and dangerous. It is the dream of not only changing the world, but also transforming people. And by changing them, you can then free them from themselves. This film will go back.
You are listening to a clip from a documentary called The Trap by Adam Curtis. It's available on YouTube. I'm Sharad Kutan, and this has been Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.